everyone to the Who Is Task Force 1 and 2 conference on the CRISP working group, and more specifically on the IRIS protocol that has made it to RFC status. And just going to wait a couple of minutes, make sure everyone is on the call. We're going to have a presentation by Andrew Newton, Leslie Diegel, and Marcos Sanz also helped put the presentation together. And then we'll follow that by a question and answer period. For those of you not on Who Is Task Force 1 or 2, we submitted to Andrew and to Leslie a list of questions that the task force had come up with. It was merely meant as kind of a guideline to let them know what types of topics that we were interested in, and so that they could prepare their presentation. But it by no means is an exhaustive list of all the questions that we had, and I'm sure there will be other questions from other people on the call. Operator, is Andrew Newton on the call? Okay, we've got silence.
Hello, sir?
Yes, hi. Has Andrew Newton or Leslie Diegel joined the call yet?
No, they're not on the call at the moment, sir.
Okay. Is Marcos, you're still on the call?
Yes, I'm here.
Marcos, would you, since they're not on the call yet, are you prepared to go through the presentation until they can join?
I haven't prepared it very well, so just wait 1 minute, because I'm sure they're going to appear, and if in 1 minute they aren't there, then I'll start with it.
Okay, so why don't we take that 1 minute, and
okay.
Sorry about that, everyone, we'll just, I see more people are joining the call now, so it may have been some glitch. Just for everyone's information, it seems we have about 22 people on the call right now.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully more will join in a couple minutes. And sorry for the silence for people that are just joining. We're just waiting for Andrew Newton or Leslie Diegel to join the call for the presentation. Marcos, just so we don't have some blank space, did you want to just go into a little bit about the, before the presentation, just maybe a little bit about the CRISP working group and the background? Do you have the presentation?
Yes, I have it.
Did you want to just start with the...
Yes, no problem.
And if Andrew and...
Yes, no problem, Jeff. I'll start with it.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So, well, it was a long time ago that we founded this CRISP working group. I don't remember. I think it's more than 2 years by now. And, CRISP is just thought it's an information service. So one of the main goals was to be clear what we wanted to design. Had to be a solution for all the problems that currently infested the nickname or Who Is protocol. The Who Is protocol is very old. It's more than 20 years old, and by the time it was designed, the standards of the ITF for protocols were not as high as they are today. So the protocol is very weak. There are no security considerations. There are no internationalization considerations. And this was identified as a problem, and this problem had to be addressed, and this is the reason why the working group was created.
Okay, so Marcos, I think we have Andrew on if you want.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, Leslie's here with me too. We were on, but you guys couldn't hear us apparently.
Put us into the muted queue, and we were sitting here screaming, but anyway.
All right, well, Marcos has filled in the beginning on the background of the group if you guys want to continue on.
Okay, sure. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the slide deck that was distributed. I hope everyone got it. And I'll go through it, and you guys can interrupt at any point and ask any questions. The questions that were provided to us are answered in the slide deck. They're just not in the same chronological order that they were asked. So you might want to be patient about that. But we will answer all the questions. At least I think they're all in here. But go ahead and feel free to interrupt at any time to ask any questions. And Marcos and Leslie will.
Yeah, I think, Andrew, the way we have the call set up is you do the presentation first, and then we'll take a queue of questions because there's about 25, 30 people on the call.
Oh, okay. That works. So starting with page 2, which is the background slide, I'll go briefly through this since Marcos already covered this. IETF chartered the CRISP Working Group in order to create a new protocol to replace the nickname Who Is Protocol. And the CRISP Working Group, what they first did was, instead of just trying to run off to implementation of a protocol, we actually created a list of requirements that we thought the protocol should have. And then we had two candidate proposals submitted to the working group. And then the working group decided took consensus on which protocol we felt best met the requirements that we had set out. And at the end of the day, IRIS was selected as the protocol. There was a second protocol based on LDAP called FERS, but the working group decided that they felt that IRIS was a better candidate, and it mostly came down to ease of implementation. IRIS is now a proposed IETF proposed standard, RFCs 3981, 3982, and 3983. Slide 3. So what IRIS is it's a very flexible, flexible information access protocol that you can layer multiple registries on top of. And the CRISP working group has worked on two registry types. We call them BREG and AREG, B for domains and A for addresses. The DREG registry type handles thick and thin registries and domain registrars. And then the AREG handles the what's called the number resource registry, or the RIRs. And I should note that before CRISP came around in the WHO is space, the RIRs and the domain registries and domain registrars were actually on completely divergent paths as far as WHO is and how they were beginning to handle WHO is. Each set of constituencies was placing different controls and different things on top of the nickname Who Is Protocol in order to meet certain requirements they had, and they were not compatible with each other. So CRISP actually is an alignment to try to bring these two back into the same camp and to allow one client to access both sets of data. There's other work actually going on with IRIS outside of CRISP. There is a thing called EREG, which is essentially an enum registry for IRIS, which is now a working group item of the enum working group within the IETF. In addition, there is a new work beginning in the IETF about emergency context resolution, and essentially that is how do you discover which emergency response center do you send emergency messages to based on geographic location. And IRIS is being set up as a proposed candidate for that solution, for that problem. And then there's also other work going on in the NGN space as well, in order to where you have a lot of convergent network technologies coming together, and they need metadata access protocols for that. Page 4. So what's the value of IRIS? Well, it's decentralized by design, and doesn't mean you can't do centralization, but it actually takes decentralization into its core essence. This is done because the feedback we got from when we went around asking people about what they wanted and in the CRISP working group itself, the registrars really, from what we heard, wanted to keep the data in their own servers. They didn't want to have to send it out to a centralized spot. That also helps in management of the data, because anytime you have data that's being centralized, there are all sorts of accuracy issues that suddenly arise that you never had before. So with decentralization, we actually have navigation built in, and we try to use DNS hierarchies where possible. And the point of doing this is so you don't have to set up a well-known server, which can be a single point of failure in the system, and it's also typically a political political hot button when you do that. And that was also a request that many people had. So what we do is we allow TLDs to put NAFTA and SRV records in their zones, pointing to their own servers. So when you do a query, you know that if I'm looking for something in, you know, .NET, that you go look up the NAFTA SRV records in the .NET zone that points to the .NET Iris server. The protocol also contains entity references and search continuations, and these are ways for a server to point to other data in other servers, whereas entity reference is an explicit knowledge reference saying, I know this entity exists over here in this server, you can go look for it, versus a search continuation which says, I think this data is over here, or this data is possibly over here, but continue your search there. And those are two, when it comes to creating a client, those are two very important distinctions that have to be made. The protocol also contains, uses a thing called SASL for multiple authentication mechanisms, and what that does is that allows us to do one-time passwords or certificates or plain passwords or whatever we want to do, but what it allows is greater flexibility in how you do access. And finally, the protocol is structured, so that allows us to do internationalization and IDN support much more easily than without structure. And we do that using XML. Going on to slide 5. What's the cost of doing this? Well, first off, Iris is an open standard published by the IETF, as we said. There's no intellectual property attached to the actual protocol itself, so you don't have to pay any royalties to anybody to go implement it. And there's no specific implementation necessary, well, because it's an open standard. So anyone's free to come up with their own implementation of the protocol as they see fit for their needs. I will point out there are some open source clients and servers already available. So if you wanted to go implement this thing on your own, the protocol was specifically designed to reuse common building blocks. So like I said, we use XML for doing the structure of the data and tagging the data. And XML is pretty much a very well-known serialization format on the internet. We use NAFTA and SRV resource records for finding and navigation of data, and also use things like SASL for common access control mechanisms. As far as the database goes, Iris is designed to sit on top of a current registration database. The intent isn't to have the database be changed in any way in order to accommodate the protocol itself. So there are no database changes at all. It's basically another protocol engine that sits on top of the database to get the access to it. And the reason we find that very important is because the moment you start requiring changes in anyone's registration database, that means it requires changes in their business processes, and that can get really expensive really fast. So Iris doesn't impose any matrices or tree structures or anything like that that requires back-end data changes. Slide 6. So the status of the CRISP status so far is the CRISP working group has met all its original milestones, which is essentially to create the requirements document and then create the core registry and the domain registry protocols. And currently the working group is working on the address registry, and in fact I expect that to go to the last call very soon. And recently we've undertaken new work on this Iris over UDP, which is to make it really fast, and another thing called D-Check, which is a lightweight domain availability check, and that will also probably be last called pretty soon. So, page 7. And there's other work going on as well. There's previously been work on putting SRV records into the zone files of TLDs so that Whois clients can find the Whois servers more easily. We are actually working on a cohabitation document which discusses how clients can use that information to find Whois servers and to find Iris servers. So essentially one client could access both Whois data and Iris data at the same time. So there's no flag day for transition. It can be an eventual gradual transition. Going to page 8, the current deployments that I know about, well, currently for CommonNet, we actually do have a server already up and running, and this year we plan on adding the UDP support once that gets finalized. In 2005, DENIC is going to stand up a server as well as Nominet, and the Rife NCC is looking at standing up a server as well. So I want to point out that with DEUK CommonNet, it represents well over 60% of all registered domains. So going to page 9. Navigation of servers and data. So I talked about this briefly before. Basically, the way IRIS uses, IRIS determines, it's one of the methods. It didn't have just one. But the way we use DNS hierarchies is we allow the zone operators to put NAFTA and SRV records in their zones, and at that point, IRIS uses that data to find the correct server to go talk to. This avoids the concept of what's known as a well-known server, just for the purposes of finding the data, which typically is a political hot button in some circles. There are other methods of finding of navigation of the data. IRIS actually has a pluggable architecture for doing that, so you can add other things. We call them resolution methods. With specific to domains, there is a top-down and bottom-up resolution methods where you start, like if you were looking for example .net, you would start looking in the zone file for example .net to see what server is, and if you didn't find it, then you go to .net. For navigation, the protocol also has what we call query distribution. This is entity references and search continuations. And entity reference is essentially saying, go look over here for this piece of data where search continuation is. Go continue your search over here at this server. What this allows is it allows registries to, the registries may point to the same data in a registrar. So com may point to the example.com in the registrar's database. And registrars can conversely point to registrants if registrants want to stand up servers. And again, like I said, there's a pluggable architecture. You can add new navigation methods if needed. Going to page 10, tiered access. What this does, IRIS has multiple authentication mechanisms, and authentication is what allows you to do tiered access, especially strong authentication. So, in tiered access, who controls what data is actually given back to the client is done by the server itself handing the data back. But the authentication allows the server to determine what type of data the user gets back. So you can actually have multiple tiers. It's not just anonymous and everything. You can have many, many tiers depending on what the policy dictates. You can also coordinate how this is done. So there's a note that you can do this in band, which is there are mechanisms within the IRIS protocol itself to allow servers to coordinate policy and authentication. It can be done out of band with some other mechanism, or it can be done in both ways in a combination. So, and what I put down here at the bottom of the slide here is a kind of an example of something I like to show is that basically. You have someone accessing an IRIS server looking for Mark Koster's or Koster's.net, which is who's my boss, and they get nothing, they get the fact that they know his name and what country he's in, which is not all that useful. But if they provide the correct authentication or the correct credentials, they get the full contact information.
And it's probably worth underscoring at this point that full contact information is what is provided in today's Whois servers. I mean, Andy actually got that out of the Whois data, and there aren't any options in today's Whois server to do anything other than just display all.
So, going on to page 11, authentication distribution. So, one of the challenges there with tiered access is how you actually know that the right user is accessing the right information without overburdening the servers providing that information. And so IRIS actually has a couple of mechanisms within it to make that burden far less than you would have with typical distribution lists. It doesn't mean you can't do it with distribution lists. Still, the old ways are still there. It's still possible. but there are other methods, and one of them is digital certificates, which is you may not understand, you know, when the client accesses the server data, the server looks at the digital certificate and says, well, I don't know who exactly who this is, but I know who gave them this cert, and therefore, based on that information, I can give them a certain level of access to the data. Or the actual certificate, since the data inside the certificate is signed, they could actually say, well, this, they know that, you know, it's maybe law enforcement or a fellow registrar or whoever, and they would then give them that, the appropriate access. And that's actually standard digital certificate technology. IRIS didn't invent any of that. There is a thing in IRIS called relay bags, and what that allows you to do is allows a server to relay via the client some opaque data to a reference server. So access can be controlled at that level if necessary, where a server, the first server may not have the data, but it refers on to the next server. But it is able to authenticate the user and then pass that authentication credential onto the reference server. We call those relay bags. The server also has another extensibility control called we call them controls in the protocol themselves, and it basically it's just another mechanism that allows a client to hand the server some extensible piece of data in order to that the server uses to act upon the request. And to give you an example of one of those things, when we implemented the IRIS server for Common Net, one of the things we wanted to do is we didn't want the speed bumping or the rate limitations from the web server to be affected, to be adversely affected, because it was actually just the web server was actually talking directly to the IRIS server. So what we did was when the web server makes a request to the IRIS server, it actually hands it a control that says, here's the requesting IP address, and therefore, of the person coming to me, and therefore, someone at a specific IP address cannot get more data via the web server or via the IRIS server if they wanted to. So they couldn't take out the system, in other words. Okay, I hope I explained that. Page 12. Again, the IRIS server is policy neutral. The protocol actually doesn't speak to policy, and that was actually one of the mantras of the CRISP working group. The CRISP working group is about creating an access protocol that didn't require any policy to be made within the protocol itself. So all sorts of information can be given back in the protocol, or it cannot be given back, or the server can actually tell the client, I have this data, but I can't give it to you. And in addition, there are other privacy mechanisms in there where the server can say this piece of data, this specific piece of data is sensitive and you are not allowed to redistribute it and things like that. The information can be, the information within IRIS can be centralized into one central IRIS server, which is a typically easy thing to do. It was designed for decentralization, so you can have it distributed. Or it can be centrally indexed and then distributed, so you could have an index server that has an index of the data but doesn't actually have the actual data itself but points to the place that does. It's all up to, this is all a matter of policy, and like I said, the protocol itself is policy neutral. And what this does is it gives policymakers a lot more tools and a lot more options in order to make policy for the situations they're determining. Point of page 13. The protocol is well structured, and what that does is it allows you better server performance because you don't have to. You're not in many cases within Whois. Sometimes the client isn't very doesn't have a lot of knowledge about what the request is, and so the servers have to kind of guess at the request. And so in many cases, not all, but what the structure does with well-known queries is allows the client to be very formal about what it's requesting, and therefore this not only sort of ambiguity on the client side, but the server then doesn't have to go hunting through multiple database indexes to find the data. It knows exactly what the client's requesting. Provides structured or normalized data. This does two things. It enables the localization of internationalized protocol elements, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute. It also provides for a richer client presentation, so the client no longer has to be very similar to only text output. It could be we have a graphical user interface that we've developed here, but you know, if it wanted to also be in Braille or whatever, whatever the end user needs and what we can program, we could do that. And the relationship to the query is clearly noted. So each, because all the data is normalized, each entity is well tagged in what the entity is. And so the relationship is clearly noted, and the relationship to whether it was a direct answer to the query or some sort of ancillary data is also noted within the protocol. When you combine all the well structured data of the queries and the responses with strong authentication, there this enables you to have very, very good audit trails if the implementer wants to do that. And only that, the other side effect is because the data is highly normalized and the queries are well known, these audit trails can actually be meaningful to third parties if necessary. Going on to page 14, again, we talk about structure and internationalization. Essentially, the way this works is that what the content of the data is under the control of the server. So the server dictates, well, I'm going to hand back the address or not, or I'm going to hand back the postal code of the user or whatever what the information is. The actual presentation of the data, though, can be determined by the client. And what this allows you to do is this allows for internationalization or localization of tags within the protocol itself. So what we have here on the slide is a picture of our graphical user client, but you'll notice that a lot of the menus and other things are not in English, they're in French. And what this does is this allows a French user to more easily look at this data and be able to figure out what's going on. And when they go click on something like the VeriSign Atlas.net domain, it opens up another window. Instead of saying domain name, it says French equivalent, which at the moment I can't think of. anyway, but it does that. Oh, if you go to the next slide, you'll actually see that on slide 15. Here's a close-up look at the data. You can see that on one side we have English, on one side we have French, and this more easily gives the end user access to the information, especially if they're a non-English speaker.
And I really want to underscore that point about the presentation of the data being localizable, because it's certainly not all that tricky a job to provide localization within interfaces for clients, but the fact that the data is structured and machine parsable makes it fairly straightforward to also apply that localization to the data itself.
Going on to slide 16, there are some questions about extensibility. Iris is a layered protocol, and we have clearly defined layers within the protocol and extensibility mechanisms built into each layer. There is an application transport layer, so we can actually have multiple application transports to meet the needs. The current one defined in core is BEEP, but we are also, like I said, we're working on a UDP version because we did some analysis, and we determined both in domain case and in address case, 90% of all queries are for single entities such as domain names or a single IP address that would map to a network. Those answers are really usually typically can be small enough to fit into one UDP packet. And as we know that if you take the transaction off the TCP, TCP by itself, no matter what, has a three packet handshake, and then also all the other sliding window stuff to keep the data going. So even at the transport level, it's a little slower than it's three times slower than UDP. So UDP would actually make it three times faster once we switch off to that. And what this also allows us to do is this allows us to say in certain cases we need to use UDP, in certain cases we need to use TCP, and so forth. And then we have the common registry, which is essentially Iris core layer, which actually describes how you talk about entities and searches and things like that. And then we have the registry specific stuff. And so we have domain registries and address registries. And you can have data from one registry point to data in another registry type, but it doesn't. What this does is it stops you from conflating the different types of data. Also, this allows you for allows reuse of these common components. A lot of these things are common components on the internet. They're easy to find, so people can implement this protocol really easily. And allows us to switch them out when necessary for newer, faster things or different use cases that may come up. And again, some of these common components are things like XML, which is pretty well known, NAPTR and SRB records, which we know about, and SASL for simple authentication, which is a authentication framework for doing different types of authentication. Slide 17. So in conclusion, basically, the IRIS e-regs are standardized, but we're the basis of what we set out to do is done. What we are currently now working on are improvements in other areas. Like I said, the address registries, we're working on that. We're working on the UDP and lightweight domain availability check. And again, there are some other work for other registries, such as Enum. The benefits of this protocol are that it's decentralized, but it has navigation as part of that decentralized and distributed manner, so you can easily, so even though it's decentralized, you can easily find the data. Better policy support via multiple authentication, because one of the things that plagues the current port 43 WHOIS protocol is the fact that the only method that people use for doing authentication right now is our IP addresses. And that works for certain things, but it really doesn't take you that far. And, of course, structure and internationalization. The structure gives us better performance and easier to understand, more less ambiguous queries and less ambiguous answers, and also allows for internationalization and better IDN support. And, of course, it's extensible because there will be future needs down the road that we currently haven't anticipated, but we want to be able to take advantage of extending the protocol for those needs. The protocol itself is low cost. It's not intended to replace anyone's database or change anyone's database. It's just intended to sit on top of the current database, much like the Port 43 engines are today. It has many authorization management features built into it so that doing distribution of authorization keys or authorization management is much easier and far less burdensome than some would think. And I'd like to point out that there are open source clients and servers already available of this protocol. Going to the last slide, slide 18. For follow-up, I've given, you know, Marcos has, here's his email address, here's mine, and here's Leslie. If you guys have any questions or concerns that you have that haven't been answered or is something you think of later, you can come send email to any one of us and we'll be happy to answer that. Or you can always go to the CRISP working group and just send emails to them as well, and you'll get an answer as well there. So, Jeff, how do you want to proceed?
Yeah, I think thanks a lot, Andy and Leslie and Marcos, for the presentation. Operator, if we could start a queue for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To restore your request, press star 2. One moment, please, for the first question. The first question comes from the line of Marilyn Cade. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I want to thank all of you, Marcos and Andrew and Leslie, for putting the presentation together. And to Andy and Leslie, let's see, has it been 3 years now, or only two, that I've been able to sit in on many of your presentations? And each time I learn something additional and valuable. So thanks so much for doing this. As you know, most of the people, or many of the people interested in this topic, in particular from the task force perspective, are non-technical. And so I think, you know, you may have questions coming from some of us that seem very simple to those of you who are technical, but challenge us who are not. I just have a couple of clarifications that I kind of didn't really understand. On the one hand, we say that CRISP is awaiting, that IRIS is really awaiting adoption, yet we see that there are some existing deployments. And could you just explain a little bit, where, and I've looked at the list of registries that are adopting, but I guess I don't really understand yet what adoption by the rest of the registries would mean, or what it would mean if not all registries adopted.
Well, I think as part of a clarification of Andy's slide on adoption, because this is not adopted, there's not a requirement for providing WHOIS services for TLDs at this point. Registries that are standing up servers for this are essentially standing up prototypes or test cases over their data. Now, those services are publicly available. I mean, that's why Andy was pointing out the one running at VeriSign Labs. So they're available for exploring the potential of this protocol. But the expectation certainly is that any operationally and formally deployed system would have to meet whatever requirements are determined by ICANN for the provision of WHOIS services going forward. So I guess that was a fairly complicated way of saying, yes, servers are being stood up for individual registries, much in the same way that one can stand up any other kind of service for the data, but there is no claim that these are the replacement for WHOIS servers at this time, because WHOIS is still formally defined as a way to provide registrant information. Now,
That's very helpful, Leslie.
That was part one of your question. Part two of your question was what happens when only some people are playing. And to that point, I think the issue is, in the same way that the current WHOIS service is somewhat bifurcated or worse, really exists in islands of deployment, in that every registry has slightly different implementations of how they present WHOIS information. There is a danger that with piecemeal deployment of IRIS servers, there is still some level of islands of data available, but not the whole space. And the only solution to that really is to develop what the deployment policy is for registries and registrars.
I just wanted to ask a couple of other questions. The task force does not have consensus opinion on whether data should be displayed or not. And are the present test or the prototype deployments restricting access to data? Or are they examining other ways of presenting data?
Well, mostly I can speak for the one at VeriSign Labs. We do with that IRIS server restrict the data for data mining purposes, but it's something on the order of I think what would take someone a year to actually go through all the data at a certain query, and I can't exactly remember. It's a pretty high number to hit, and in fact, on our WHOIS servers, we don't actually see those type of query rates. We don't see that. The thing is that once you stand up the servers themselves, and that allows people with clients to start playing around with how they want to see the data to begin with, and that's the important thing. So to answer the second part of your question, the intent of our current server is to allow clients to access the data and to be able to do what they need to with that data in a highly structured manner.
And Andy, sorry, so who would you define as a client in this case?
Who would I define as a client?
Oh.
Basically, we have two methods of access. We have the IRIS port access, which is what's defined in the actual protocol spec. And so someone can go download an IRIS client, the client software. I'm trying not to be technical there. They take the client software and they can access it. There are two pieces of client software currently available. One's written in Perl, one's written in Java, and they can go access this data. The other way is we have a web interface, and basically our website basically just talks to the Iris server, so they could that way they don't have to actually go download a client. But what this does is this allows them to get to the data if they want to via a web interface. And we can, and if you go to the website, which is iris.verisignlabs.com, you can see that we play around with how that data should look to users and so forth. And we do this because it's not textual, it's not unstructured textual data. We can actually do that.
Now, sorry, Andy, my question wasn't clear. When I use the term client as a consultant, I mean the people who I'm working for. What I meant by client is, I should have asked, what kind of users are accessing the data by category? Is it law firms? Is it registrars? Is it law enforcement? Is it business organizations? That's what I meant. Or do you know?
Well, currently we don't know because we don't have any. We haven't placed any strong authentication on the server at present. And one of the reasons we haven't done that is, first off, we don't want to step on anyone's toes, especially the ICANN who is Task Force. So we're kind of waiting to see what you guys come up with in that regard. But in addition, we're only a thin registry for Common Net at the moment, and so we're not really sure how much of the information we have is all that, interesting, I guess, to some users. But we are looking at what we can do, what makes sense as far as restriction of the data and data access to certain clients. But we don't know at present who they are.
Yeah, so it's not the case that we've been directly targeting specific customer segments, if you will, and saying, here's a new service that you should go and use. It is more the case that this is, we put the server up because, as you know, this whole process of, 3-4 years is sort of delicate steps forward on multiple fronts. And having defined the protocol, it's now important to actually put it up where people can actually work with it. Where whose task force members can go and play with it and get a sense of, aha, so this is what's feasible technically, and just get a sense of, of what is feasible and what the range of possibilities are to help inform the range of possible policy decisions.
Thanks. And my next question, and then I will get back into queue at another time, has to do with a statement that you made that authorization is easier and less burdens than some people think. But the two areas that I saw suggested as forms of authentication did not seem to me to take into account the developing country issue, where certificate authorities are, and the use of credit cards is very different than it is, of course, in the developed world. Is there, are we assuming that authentication will be possible, but we're not assuming that it would be mandatory unless there's a policy recommendation. Would that be right?
Yes, that's accurate. The protocol doesn't make it, has no assumptions about who gets what access to what data. That's all a policy decision. With regards to certificate authorities, don't think of commercial certificate authorities such as VeriSign. And you could definitely do that with a commercial certificate authority. It doesn't necessarily have to be. So the U.S. government has its own certificate authorities that it has, and those could be used as well as the certificate authorities of any government or any organization. So anybody could act. We could actually talk about the certificate authority of any organization. It doesn't have to be a commercial entity. And I also want to note that a particular server can use the multiple certificate authorities. It doesn't have to be a certificate authority per server. It could be multiple certificate authorities per server.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Operator, is there anyone else in the queue?
Yes, the next question comes from Maureen Coverley. Please go ahead.
Hello, this is Maureen Coverley. Marilyn, thanks for introducing the questions that way. I have the same view, that there are some of the technical things may be complex, but nonetheless they seem to flow into some fundamental questions. I'd like to ask a question about slides 10 and 11, where we're were talking about the tiered access and authentication distribution. When we talk about the multi-type authentication methods, simple question, does IRIS draw a line between the categories of viewable information, the types of viewable information that exist, and how customizable is that?
Maybe I may chime in and answer that question. That's not directly a protocol issue. That's more the policy you have developed for your own registry. You just have to implement it. And IRIS supports for it. So it's not that IRIS says, well, there are going to be just four levels of access or five levels or the different, this number of different information categories. This is something that you can implement locally. And IRIS allows for communicating that maybe you are not allowed to access this kind of information at the authorization level you are using at the moment.
Okay, thank you. So it's infinitely customizable, though. That would be the answer, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, is there anyone else?
We're showing no further questions. Once again, it's star followed by one to ask a question.
This is Jeff. Let me ask a question in the meantime. I think you had said something about the fact that it's that response times shouldn't be affected by layering the IRIS protocol on top.
No, it shouldn't be.
And that's true whether it's a thick registry or a thin registry.
It actually is better for a thick registry. It helps in both situations. But a thin registry doesn't have that many indices. Essentially, a thin registry doesn't have as many indices to look across as a thick registry. And therefore, because the queries are well structured and basically a lookup is defined as going in the protocol as hitting hitting a certain one index. Therefore, in a thick registry, you'd actually probably get better performance.
Maybe somebody is thinking that because of this whole graphical presentation levels, that this implies that there are lots of data being transmitted, and obviously everything has to be much slower. This is not true. I just want to say it very clearly, because this graphical thing that Andy presented, that is something that it's running on the client, so the amount of data that it's being actually transmitted over the net, it's very, very small. It's admittedly a little bit more than transmitted via the WHOIS protocol. There's a slight overhead, but this overhead doesn't account for a bigger delay in response times when compared with factors that are much more important, like, I don't know, the actual speed of your relational database on the server, or how far away you are physically located from the server. So this overhead that IRIS carries is not relevant to the response times, not practically relevant.
Yeah, I just want to reinforce what Marcos just said. You're not going to see any most of the latency that comes with a Whois query or an IRIS query is basically transit time of the packets and the actual data lookup within inside the database. The actual marshaling of the data is usually that's pretty pretty small compared to the time it takes to do the other things. And I'd like to point out that we are, even though we have finished the core work, we're still looking at ways of making this even better. And so one of the things we're doing is this UDP work, where we're trying to offload what statistically we found are 90% of all our queries into the UDP space. So at the network level, it becomes three times faster. It doesn't mean your database is going to be any faster, but at the network level, it becomes three times faster. And UDP, the load on a server, UDP is much less. So You can look at a DNS server. DNS servers, for what they do, are actually pretty lightweight. They actually handle a lot more load per CPU than, like, say, a web server. And the reason for that is because the vast majority of their traffic is over UDP. So those are things where we're looking. We're still refining, and we're even talking about another, an even more refined TCP transport. But that's currently work that we're just now looking into. I don't think there would be no reason why you couldn't meet your current SLAs that you have now, and in fact in the future this protocol will be even faster. So.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Anyone else in the queue?
There's a follow up question from Marilyn Cade. Please go ahead.
I have a number of questions, so let me ask them, and then other people may. It may spark some questions from others, but I don't want to. I've had the benefit of thinking about this for a number of years, so I don't want to accommodate. Let me just go through a few questions, and then maybe the three of you can dialogue with us about it. A couple of things come to my mind. One is I'd like to kind of understand. We opened the conversation by saying that the existing nicknames WHOIS protocol was developed many years ago, and we all know that we've learned a lot, and that in fact the internet has changed a great deal since then. So if IRIS were implemented today, if there were a consensus policy, for instance, that supported the implementation of IRIS, and I'm speaking very hypothetically. If it were implemented today, full display of all data that is gathered, what exists in IRIS that will help with the accuracy problem, which is a serious problem in today's WHOIS? That'd be one question I have. Secondly, what exists or could exist with the implementation of IRIS that would allow the discrimination between category of registrant? For instance, in a .post, which is announced by ICANN staff as being under negotiation or as authority, I think that's right, and .post, as I recall from their application, provide something equivalent to a post office box where they gather accurate data, but that accurate data is not displayed. But in another TLD, there might be a different kind of category of user, like a user who says, okay, I'm an individual and I've authenticated I'm an individual. Does IRIS allow us to discriminate in the display of data between different categories of users? My next question has to do with really trying to understand the cost and the burden on registries and registrars of moving in this direction, and whether there's a transitional period or a transitional cost anytime. As I will know from having run a business, any time you adopt a new software, adopt a new means of doing something, you have a number of both hard and soft costs, including training of your people. What are the cost areas that we should be thinking about if we were to move forward in this direction? That's my short list.
Okay. Well, I'll try to attack the accuracy question. First off, IRIS is only an access protocol. It's not a provisioning protocol. So most of the accuracy comes in on the provisioning side, not the access side. You could potentially sign the data that's coming out of the IRIS server, so you would know that it's authentic, but that's one thing. But I think the big answer to that is that people will be much more willing to make sure their data is accurate, or they'd be much less apprehensive about providing accurate data if they didn't think that it was going to be shown to everyone on the planet. That's my quick answer for that. Leslie or Marco?
I think that's about right, and I think it does somewhat lead into the second question about distinguishing between categories of users. I mean, I think the point with allowing signing of data, et cetera, is from a display perspective, you can make the distinction between types of data and types of users. And, I mean, I think it becomes a question of deployment realities, whether that's useful or not.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Andy, I have noted your comment and Leslie's support for your personal view and perspective that people will be more willing to provide accurate data or less apprehensive if not shown to everyone on the planet. I think that the task force doesn't have a consensus view on that. And
Well, note that I think what we're saying is that is the limit and extent to which IRIS supports a solution to the accuracy problem. I mean, we certainly recognize there's a much larger issue about detecting and ensuring accuracy of data, and that's just simply beyond the scope of IRIS.
Yeah, Marilyn, this is Jeff. Can we see if there's anyone else in the queue?
We can, but I just want them to pursue slightly. The task force doesn't have the consensus on that particular point, but the task force, and I understand that IRIS isn't the answer to accuracy. Are there other steps that could be taken, or are there other activities underway that could address the accuracy problem, leaving aside the display issue, but could address the accuracy problem?
I don't think those are protocol problems. I'm actually not even sure if they're technological problems. It sounds more like a social issue. Technology can help you with this problem. It will not solve the problem. But most of it, like I said, is on the provisioning side. So if it's not within the EPP protocol, then it would actually be within the EPP implementations themselves that would have to do some sort of accuracy checking or whatnot. Or it may actually just be people, who do the checking. I know what we do here at VeriSign on the certificate authority side, even though I don't work for that division, I know what they do, and they actually have people, humans in the loop to do this thing, because you actually can't get computers to do it.
I think the answer is that all technology can do is help to accurately convey the level of confidence in the accuracy of the data. So, I mean, you can convey that the registry or the registrar believes this data to be accurate, and that's about all that you can do.
And can you go on to address my last question, which was more about what you kind of saw as the different areas of cost?
Well, about the costs and burdens, if I may chime in again, I think that Andy already addressed this in the presentation. There are no IPRs, there is software which is for downloading out there. It's open source, so you really can check what you are running on your machines. And somehow the only excuse that I could find for somebody not to implement it is this initial investment that you always need when you have to deploy something new. You have to get along with it, you have to learn something. And we all are always a little bit lazy when we have to learn something new. And so this is the only burden that I could find to start implementing something like that. But on the other hand, we've already seen the list of advantages, and I really think that the advantages are worth it.
Another point I'd like to add is I think that some of the cost incurred is going to be in changing whatever business policies, business practices to meet the policies that are agreed on, and that's nothing to do with IRIS. I mean, what I mean is, if there is a policy to move to accepting distinctions between categories of user, et cetera, then registries and registrars are going to have to look at how they categorize users and make sure that all of their data systems support that. But that really has nothing to do with an IRIS deployment. That's just a change in the who is service question.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And I think you said this, Andy, but I just want to verify it. So, hypothetically,
let's say that we have tiered approach, and it would be possible, if the implementation supported this, for certain categories to say, of users to say, I wish to have all data displayed, and other categories to say, I don't want data displayed.
Yes, yes. That's absolutely correct. It's whatever the policy, whatever you know, whoever's setting the policy, you know, the ICANN, who is task force, or whoever, says that, you know, law enforcement gets to see this data item, this data item, this data item, whereas, you know, registrars get to see everything, or what, I, you know, I don't know, I can't even begin to speculate what that would be, but it is a matter of policy only.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Different question.
But yes, it is the case also that an individual user can say, I'm willing to have my address shown publicly, or no, I'm not willing.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't understand that.
Good answer. Both were helpful.
Okay, can we, operator, anyone else in the queue right now?
The next question comes from a Mickey Mouse. Please go ahead.
Okay. Calling all Mickey Mice.
I suppose that was probably not a serious one.
I believe it was someone who refused to give their name, sir. So, excuse me, your line is now open. In that case, we'll take the next question from Ryan Laning. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Steve Metalis with Ryan at this end. I just a follow-up question to one or two of Marilyn's questions. When you say it's not a provisioning protocol, it doesn't affect then what goes in. I mean, what you're saying is it doesn't affect what goes into the Whois database. It's merely a question of what comes out of the Whois database in response to a query. Is my understanding right?
That'd be correct.
So in that case, the question about different registrants allowing or specifying different data to be made available, that does require categorizing registrants, and I'm just not clear on exactly how IRIS helps with that. You have to distinguish between a registrant who says, all my data can be available, as opposed to a registrant who says, let's assume that the policy allowed, none of my data would be available.
That's true that distinction has to be made within the database, but the issue is that what will happen is when an IRIS query comes in, and the query is made to the database, the data either is provided to as part of the response or it is not. Because inbound on the query is also an indication as to whether or not this is, you know, a general anonymous question or whether there is any level of authentication and credentials available.
That I understand that it can distinguish between who is requesters.
Yep.
But in terms of distinguishing among domain name registrants, just to take the domain name side of this, it doesn't do that. There has to be a distinction in there that it will then honor.
The distinction must be captured in the data held by the registry or registrar.
And I'll point out that EPP does that.
EPP does that.
EPP has those type of capabilities already in it, so registrants or registrars can tell a registry the desires of the registrant.
Yeah, this is Jeff Newman. Just to clarify, it's got that in the protocol, but the registries, that's EPP 1.0, and the registries are in the process of implementing it, but most registries at this point, so the policy is decided, don't activate those privacy flags yet.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. That again, here's something that the protocol provides that policy has not stated as needed or as even maybe has even overridden in some cases. So the registrants could be saying, I don't want any of my data showing, and it's just not a policy decision that's allowed to be made. So essentially, law enforcement could, you know, I'll give you the example that a registrant has said, I don't want any of my data to be shown to anybody ever except for me, and a law enforcement person comes into an IRIS server and then says, and authenticates as law enforcement. The policy could therefore be, it doesn't matter what the registrant asks for. The policy is that the law enforcement gets to see this data. So, or it could be that the law enforcement doesn't get to see this data. I mean, that, like, again, that's all a matter of policy.
Okay, but to the extent that there is a differentiation, given holding the requester constant, to the extent that there's a differentiation, what's returned from the query based on characteristics or desires of a registrant, IRIS does not have that capability. That would have to be an EPP capability that's used, or else that protocol would have to be adapted to provide that capability. Is that right?
I think we're having a problem with terminology. Because I think the right answer to your question to convey to you what you want to hear is yes, but I'm not comfortable in saying that IRIS doesn't have the capability in distinguishing between users, because I believe it does.
It does, if that distinction is already there in the database.
Right. There would be no way for IRIS to fabricate interpolate what the registrant's desires were.
Yes. Okay. No, that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Paul Stahua. Please go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, let's say we had a policy. I'm kind of worried about people who have the correct authentication getting the data and then distributing it to people who don't have the correct authentication. It's a policy thing, but I'm wondering if IRIS can help. Let's say we had a policy that said people with this authentication can only keep the data for 24 hours and to live on it. Can IRIS help us there?
Well, I am sorry to say I don't think that IRIS can help, because once the data has been delivered, there is no real way to track what is happening with this data and for how long this data is going to be kept at the other side.
That really requires proprietary software to accomplish that. I mean, it's really hard to watermark data in such a way that people, yeah, one, don't notice, but this is all textual data, which is even much harder to watermark. And then on top of that, if you want to do something similar to, you know, DRM or whatnot, like, let's, you know, take the example of what iTunes does. Well, iTunes is proprietary software, and that's exactly how they accomplish that task. So you can't really say we're going to have an open standard and then require everyone to go get a certain piece of software. I mean, that's not
what you're saying, and I understand that if somebody's not following the protocol, they could ignore. Let's say there was a time to live on this piece of data, they could ignore that, but then they would be breaking the protocol by following it.
Well, I mean, I think the issue is that they're breaking the policy, and what you need is mechanisms for detecting if there are continuous bad actors doing that. You know, for instance, if there's a registry client that has signed an agreement not to do that, and they're repeatedly doing it, there should be the ability to turn around and you know, revoke their rights. To follow on Andy's iTunes example, I don't know how many people on the call are familiar with that particular piece of software and service, but another, apart from the fact that it's proprietary software, I think two important aspects need to be understood about how it achieves the control of the digital material. And those are, it not only requires their specific software, it also means that their software has to anticipate what are appropriate and likely use cases. And those are the ones that are supported for all users across the globe. And that's not the sort of thing that we've seen as being applicable for Whois. I mean, Marilyn mentioned earlier some of the ways in which different regions of the world are very different in terms of their needs and abilities. The other thing I would observe is the fact that, well, okay, in the case of iTunes, since this is dealing with music, which is very popular, of course, it wasn't that long before there started to exist software which ripped the digital rights management controls out of the data, and then you're right back to square one. And, you know, if it was of sufficient interest to people to do that here, exactly the same thing would happen.
But if you want a short answer, yes, you could put a TTL on the data if you really wanted to. I don't know if that's what you were getting after, but yeah, you can put a time to live on there, and if someone violates it, they're a bad actor.
You can provide mechanisms, you can't provide enforcement.
Right. I'm just wondering if it was in the protocol at all. I understand that, you know, if somebody breaks the policy of ignoring the TTL, or if the policy was a contract with the people who are getting the information to say you can't store it, or you can't pass it on or whatever, I see that it really can't help us because, yeah, we're not implementing some kind of digital right management thing, and we would need a proprietary client or thing on the front end to enforce all that. I see that. But I'm wondering if it had a TTL, at least people who got the quote unquote standard clients, or reference clients or whatever that I would guess would be built, would at least have that, and then they'd have to build their own client if they want to violate that TTL.
Well, I mean, okay, so I'll give you an example. If you go to, you can put in those types of policies if you want. If you go to the ComNet IRIS server, you can actually see where we have stuck in, you know, you're not allowed to use this data for spamming, okay? That it's not going to stop anyone from using it from spamming, but we have that in there where we put the notice saying you can't use this data for spamming, and therefore we've given them the notice. And if they do it, they're in violation.
Right, I see that. Also, if you had a TTL, then your web-based client would not be able to store the information if you complied with the spec. Is that correct?
Okay, so if you're asking specifically, is there a TTL in the actual current DREG spec? No, there is not. Could one be added very easily? Very, very easily. I can do it in about 2 minutes. So we could do that. I do want to point out, though, that this is textual data. Someone could easily just cut and paste it, and it wouldn't even require a new reference, a new implementation of the client to do it. They could easily just cut and paste that data, and off they go.
So this is more or less the reason why I said at the beginning that it's not feasible.
Okay, should we, operator, anybody else in the queue?
We're showing no more questions at this time, sir.
All right, can I then ask my own question, a follow-up on the audit trail comment you had talked a little bit about in the presentation. Would this make it possible for the server to collect information about the requester of the information and distribute that information out to, let's say, the registrant?
Yes, I want to be explicit about this. Audit trail is actually not a function of the protocol. It's a function of the implementations of the protocol. But what we do, you do have the benefit of the fact that because the data is highly normalized, therefore it's well understood what was accessed and by whom. Of course, when you use strong authentication, you can say, here's the actual serial number of the certificate, or here's the user ID of the person who came and got this data, and they got this specific piece of data. They didn't just actually query any, their query didn't, they entered this query and they got a bunch of data back. So yeah, so the audit trails would then be meaningful to a registrant or to any third party.
And if you were serving up data with only anonymous access, then you could provide information in terms of the number of accesses to the data.
And since the queries are much more structured, you can really categorize and have very fine granulated policies in the sense of, I don't know, this person is only allowed to make 10 queries regarding person data per minute, but he's allowed to make 100 queries regarding domain data per minute, because you really know what the person is querying, so you have very fine granulation over it.
I also want to add that there is a particular type of SASL authentication mechanism or access mechanism called one-time passwords, and it's basically a cryptographic password solution that where a password is only good a certain number of times. So you issue the password, and it can only be used in a certain number of times before cryptographically it can no longer be used again. So not even an account administrator could go in and say, I'll up the number or whatever. Basically, once the password is handed out, it is handed out and it can only be used a finite number of times for access.
Well, in the case of certificates, this is much more extreme. Even if you were able to keep track of all data that the client has sent to the server, there is no way for the server to impersonate the client.
Okay. Let me just check. Is there anyone else in the queue?
We have a follow-up question from Marilyn Cade. Please go ahead.
Have you gone through the questions that we submitted to just, because you just asked one that I know had not been asked. Is that what you were going to do next?
That's what I'm going through right now.
Okay. Because I wanted to ask a follow-up question. It's very much aligned with what we were just talking about, and then I think it's consistent with the questions that we're going through. On the ability, as you were saying, that this really has to do with the implementation. So on the ability to identify who has submitted the request, gather data on the type of request that is being asked, whether it's just availability of domain name or actually information about contact, et cetera, is there any mechanism in IRIS that would allow when incorrect or inaccurate data is identified, is there any mechanism in IRIS that would flag that? Or if fields are left blank, it's possible to print out a report showing that a certain percent of the data that is being input by the registrant is being left blank, those kinds of reporting statistics?
How do you mean block that? Not being delivered to the client?
You know, you're right, Marcus, because this is an overlay to the underlying database.
Yes, I mean, it's just about delivering. It's just not about entering the data. And obviously, the implementation you have, you can keep track whenever you are answering a query whether you've found some, let's say, not well-formed data in your database. That's possible. But I think that's too late. I mean, you are just realizing you have something inaccurate or not well-formed, and you should have check that before entering it into the database. Does this answer your question?
I don't think so, but it was helpful in any case. because I'm learning more. My question, let me see if I can refine my question. One of the things that the registrars are responsible for right now is upon being notified that there's inaccurate data, they need to take steps to notify the registrant of the registrant's responsibility to correct that data. Is that...
Okay, I see. Well, it's much more easier now with this protocol to identify, let's call, inaccurate data, in the sense that the protocol is much more structured than who is what. So now you have very well-defined fields. Here you have to have a telephone number, and the telephone number has to have this format, and otherwise it's wrong. And the protocol itself provides this information, so XML itself provides this information. So it's very easy for a registrar to check the results coming against a predefined, let's call, format, and get aware whether the data is fulfilling the rules defined in this schema.
Okay, that's very helpful. That's what I was looking for, was the reporting.
Okay. Any other follow-ups to that? Operator, anybody else in the queue?
No, there are no more questions at this time.
Okay, let me, one other question I had was on the Whois servers. If there's an Irish server that's run by the registry, it would be that individual server that defines what the output is, correct?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, so let's say that, ICANN says that there's a policy that certain classes of users see certain types of data, but the decision is ultimately the server operator who sends that to the client. So if they didn't do what ICANN's asking them to, then they're in violation of ICANN policy. But you're right. However, because, you know, as Marcus pointed out, because the data is well structured, it's easy to figure out what they're, you know, when they're not conforming with policy.
One more question on the structure, on the data structure. Although you initially talked about the cost being pretty low, are there costs imposed on the operators for existing names to basically put all of that data in the correct, in the format that's specified by IRIS?
Well, no. The intent is that you don't have to restructure your database or do anything to your database. Basically, you're just accessing the database in the same way that the Whois or the current Whois servers are doing it. So, and we actually, you know, spent some time on this in the CRISP working group. We wanted to make sure that the protocol itself didn't require any type of reorganization of the indexes or anything like that, because we felt that if that occurred, then suddenly this is too burdensome to implement.
I would refine that slightly and say that the cost essentially is in a software that does the translation, the mapping between your existing software and, you know, providing data in the IRIS protocol. It doesn't have to be a flat out conversion of data databases or, you know, the back end software tools. The other thing that I would say is just reiterating a point I made earlier is that to the extent that there are changes needed in that back end database, it's going to be to support required support policy changes. It's not a software question.
Right. So basically, it'll be the translator that, you know, registry. Let's just take a phone number for example. Some registries start with, you know, the country code as with a plus sign versus just having the number out there without the plus sign. You know, and some have it separated by periods, and some might use hyphens.
Right.
You're just talking about there would be a conversion software,
yes,
that would convert it. It wouldn't make any changes in the database, but convert it so when it's
right
displayed. Okay.
Right. Whereas if there are policy changes about, you know, only display the first 5 telephone numbers, et cetera, or only display telephone numbers for people whose last names start with D, that's something that, you know, would be needed whether you're using IRIS to access this or Whois.
Okay. I think that answers all the questions we have in the question form that we gave you. Operators, anybody else?
Yes, the next question comes from Steve McAllis and Ryan Lenning. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I think it's a follow-up on this same point. I thought I heard that, again, this goes to the question of the accuracy of the data in the database, and I thought I heard the statement that the accuracy would be improved because the fields are well-defined. But let me just take an example. Let's say that the phone number that's listed is 123, which we know is an inaccurate number because phone numbers have more than that many digits. Could somebody explain how IRIS would help you determine that this was inaccurate compared to the status quo?
I think on the outside, in terms of a client looking in as opposed to the provisioner, the issue is that you understand that this is asserted to be the phone number as opposed to wondering whether this was a fragment of, for instance, a zip code.
Okay, so as the Whois requester, I would have a higher degree of confidence than I do today that this is really the phone number listed in the database.
Yeah, well, you understand the assertion that this is the phone number.
Yes.
Right.
It's not that you have a higher confidence that this is the phone number listed in the database. You can have the absolute confidence that this is the data listed as delivered by the server. The point is, this is not the definition of accuracy. It depends on the definition of accuracy you're using. You do have accuracy if you interpret it, this is the data delivered by the server. But 123 is obviously not a valid phone number.
Okay. This is Ryan jumping in. Can you have confidence that that was what the registrant entered as the telephone number?
You can only have the confidence that that is the data that the registry is delivering you.
Okay.
If you trust the registry...
Yeah, so I think that goes back to kind of a disconnect in the terminology. When I first hear the question about accuracy, I think about the provisioning side. The questions you guys have been asking is accuracy in how the client understands the structure of the data. But when it comes to accuracy as to what's in the database, again, that's more of a provisioning instrument that has to be undertaken. And again, like I said, I think ultimately that's not a there's no there are technologies to help and technologies to detect inaccuracies, but there are not technologies to actually make it accurate.
Okay. And my other follow-up question was really on, I think it was our question 2D, the audit trail question. I think it was stated that this is not a function of the protocol, but of implementation. And so our questions about, you know, if there is a record of the query, where is it stored, and who has access to it, those are all questions that would be decided by the implementation of the protocol. And the implementation could say you only have access to it if you present a court order, or it could say the registrar has access to this for marketing purposes, or it could say anything.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
The next question comes from Maureen Cabilly. Please go ahead.
Thank you. On an entirely different topic, one of the early questions, I believe it was from Marilyn, was about what does this mean if not all registries adopt it? And you do have an item in your presentation about Port 43 cohabitation. So I'm just wondering if you could tell us what are the main issues that you're working on in order to enable both IRIS and those registries that choose to stay with what they've got with Port 43. What are the issues around compatibility and around ensuring that it's a smooth running system and that the access protocol that you've described for us is complementary, if not supportive, to what's already happening with those registries that stick with Port 43?
Well, it's not. I mean, since Port 43 is not really all that complicated of a protocol. I mean, you could write a to his client in about, you know, 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
Putting that functionality into an IRIS client is really you know, not that difficult to do. The only thing there is that the person, you know, the end user sitting at the IRIS client doesn't get the IRIS benefits of accessing Whois data over Port 43. So they're basically when we talk about cohabitation, it's a way of allowing the navigation, some of the navigation elements within IRIS to actually be backported to Port 43, so you can easily find the correct Whois server. You still don't have query distribution and some of the other nicer things that are built into IRIS, but at least you can do that. And so you would have one piece of software that could talk to the Whois servers and one piece of software that could talk to the IRIS servers. And you don't get all the IRIS functionality out of Port 43, but still it means that you don't have to go through multiple different ways of getting that data.
Okay, so it's one query, it will go to wherever. It doesn't. There's not a hierarchy of ranking the way that it's accessed, then, is that right?
Well, I think that there is the ability to express preference, and naturally preference would be for towards IRIS servers, because the truth is that it is IRIS clients who will be making use of this, right? Because Whois clients don't have any notion of this idea of cohabitation or anything else. But it is at least a mechanism for, you know, as Andy said, sort of bringing those Whois servers into the fold to the navigation side of what IRIS provides. It's still more or less like, you know, you get to that point and there's a hand-painted arrow pointing down a very pothole-ridden, boulder-strewn dirt road. You know, go down there at your peril, but there it is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The next question comes from Marilyn Cade. Please go ahead.
You know, we sort of skipped past something that you said earlier, which is actually very important to ISPs and big infrastructure providers, and that is, and to business users themselves. We rely on not only the DNS Whois, but also on the Whois that is maintained by the RIRs. And you mentioned that one thing that IRIS does is to bring together a form of consistency across those two Whois's.
Yes.
Is that a word? Who is this?
I guess, yeah.
Twice.
Could you, you know, just sort of elaborate a little bit on what the status is with the RIRs and kind of what's going on there from to the extent you know it?
Yeah, the RIRs, all four RIRs are current participants of the CRISP Working Group, and in fact, one of the co-chairs of the CRISP Working Group is George Michelson, who's the CTO of APNIC. The RIPE NCC is doing a lot of work in this area. Ingen Gundes and Shane Kerr, who work for the RIPE NCC, have actually are now owners of the draft that talks about how the address registries are to be structured over IRIS. And in fact, We believe that it'll go to the last call pretty soon within the CRISP Working Group, and they've worked pretty pretty strenuously to get this right. And we have engaged with Aaron and Lacknick as well, and Aaron was very involved with this as well. And so a lot of what was going on there is coordination between the RIRs and the different data models that they have. There's actually between the four RIRs, there's three different data models. Are three different types of registries that they have, and so a lot of that was just making sure that we got it right, and I believe we do have it right now. I mean, it's been, I guess we started that a year ago with the address, I can't really remember when we started it, but it seems like it was about a year ago when we started with it, so Aaron and the RIPE NCC and APNIC and LACNIC are all talking with each other, and then they represent each other within the CRISP Working Group. And so we're now going ahead with what we're calling AREG.
I'm sorry, Aaron, APNIC.
LACNIC, which is the Latin America.
Hi.
And the RIPE NCC.
RIPE NCC. And the provisional APNIC is participating or not yet?
We haven't seen any evidence of them, but my suspicion is that's largely because they've got more primary things on their mind.
Right.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
And a lot of how things work within the RIR space, I don't want to speak for them, but I'll just say what I've observed, is the RIPE NCC has software that they develop, and it's reused by the other RIRs. And so what happens is once the RIPE NCC has done it, then the others will take it on. And this is extremely true with the Whois servers. The Whois servers run by APNIC are actually the ones that the RIPE distributes.
Yeah.
So, and this is true for what they call the NIRs as well. I'm sorry, Marcus, did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to confirm that it's a behavior I've observed as well.
Okay. Operator, anybody else in the queue?
The next question comes from Chuck Goins. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Chuck Goins from VeriSign. Several times it's been stated that the provisioner of the data is the registry. And I'm assuming that because of the distributed nature of IRIS, that the provisioner of the data could actually be be a registrar. And then you don't have the duplication of both registry and registrar being authoritative for the data. While at the same time, the registry would be the provider of the IRIS Whois service. Is that a correct assumption on my part?
Chuck, I'm not sure I actually understood the question.
Well, several people have said that the data is coming from registry in every case. That could just as well be a registrar that the data is coming from instead of a registry. Is that correct?
Yes. I think as I've been speaking, when I say registry, I'm actually meaning a generic versus a thick, thin domain registry or a registrar. I mean, a registrar is a type of registry.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thanks.
Sorry if I was inaccurate.
The next question comes from Paul Stahura. Please go ahead.
It's funny, my question is a little bit related to that. In your slide, I have two questions. The first one, in your slide, you said registrars may point to registrants and registries may point to registrars. I understand that. My question is, what if some of the information is contained in the registry for a particular query and some of it's at the registrar? I assume that there's some kind of provision for replying with some information from the registry and some from the registrar.
It really is all in how the client wishes to present that data to the end user. But the important part on the server side is that the server knows how to properly say, here's the domain information I have, and by the way, I know registrar X has this domain information as well. You may go access it over there. But how the client wishes to present that to the end user is really a presentation style of the client itself. I've got certain theories in how best a client would do that, which I've tried to implement within our GUI work here. And I know other people have talked about other ways of doing that. But the client itself, the client software, can access the data in both places. And the entity reference is well understood by the client, so he knows that the registry has some data and the registrar has some data at the same time, and knows to go get it in both places.
So the protocol really supports that, so you can really combine data from different repositories.
What if data is different? For example, the registry replies that, oh, this is the registrant name, and by the way, you could get this other information over at the registrar, and then the registrar says, this is the registrant name, and it's different. Then the client has to reconcile that somehow by which one does it use?
That's a matter of how it wishes to present the data. In the client software that I have, I actually have this what's called a tree widget or a tree control, which actually is used for doing the representation, so you can see that here's the data the registrar has. Here's the data that the registry has. The registry and underneath that in the tree, you see the point where the registrar has. And so the user can actually bring up both, click on both pieces of data, pull them side by side, and see that they're different. Specifically, the client could actually be programmed to be able to flag that and start blinking in big red letters, oh, they differ, or something like that. But that is a function of how the client would see the data.
Yeah, I think the important thing to keep in mind is that essentially IRIS is making sure that it keeps track not only of the data for this given record, but also where it got the data. That's a key element of what it's aware of.
I follow that, thanks. My second question is kind of related to query limit. Somebody said earlier that based on the certificate or the authentication of the user, that particular user not only might not be able to see certain information, but also might be limited to a certain number of queries per day. Did I catch that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's really a matter of policy.
Okay, so my question is, I think that, for example, a user type, I could be wrong on this, but can a user type in joe@hotmail.com as an email address and query the system to say, return all the domain name, whois information, for any domain name that has that email address in one query?
I believe so. So you're asking is can the user submit that query and say, I want all domain names with certain email address, and they'll get all the domain names, or are you asking if the server can limit how many domains they get back?
First of all, if there was no limit, they would get all the WHOIS information for all the domain names at Hotmail, let's say.
Not necessarily. I mean, the server can limit the number of answers it gets back. So even though there may be 1,000, the real answer to that is 1,000 domains, the policy can be you can only see 100 of them.
Okay, follow that. Thank you.
Thank you. We are showing no further questions at this time.
Okay, I just then I'll take this opportunity to thank our presenters, Andrew Newton, Leslie Diego, and thank you again, and Marco. Thanks again for your presentation. the presentations have been sent to the task force list, which is a publicly accessible list. If there's anybody that can't access it, or feel free to send the GNSS secretariat an email to get a copy of the presentation. Again, want to thank you guys, and I'm sure we'll have a number of follow-up questions for you, possibly a follow-up call later on in the future, but again, thanks a lot.
Well, I'd like to say thank you, too. We've certainly appreciated the opportunity to speak about this, and as always, I think that I'd like to end on the point that we're only trying to build technology that will, you know, suit the needs that you're defining. So to the extent you can keep us aware of the needs and the progress in your deliberations, it will really help our process in meeting our goal. So thanks a lot.
Yes, it was my pleasure as well to have somebody who wants to hear about this.
Okay, everyone, thank you for joining the call. And the next task force call for those on the task force is on next Tuesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.